It's the Global Austerity edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, dangers of overselling vaccine, Canada's endangered scientist, mystery water, and part one of three interview with Seth Klein from the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives. This week, austerity, does it work?
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. Place where reason and reality cross swords for politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of sparks. We are away. The cosmos can know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are other suns. We've traveled this way before. And there is much to be learned.
T-minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. And launch of the SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket as NASA turns to the private sector to resupply the International Space Station.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. And that was just a short segment from the SpaceX launch, the successful version of it that was delayed on Sunday. But we have the climactic version that didn't sort of fizzle out after the countdown.
Yes. And this is Don, your political science philosopher, going, yay, boo, yay, boo. I mean, yay, because, hey, more space flight, the better. Boo, well, I'm not really a big fan of private space flight, but that's a me thing. But it was quite hilarious, the last launch, which you're kind of alluding to. Anyone who's listened to it, it was I swear, it was like a sitcom sort of thing where they went down, you know, 3, 2, 1, we don't have a launch.
Yeah, it was a little bit sad. But it launched earlier this morning, I guess, well, very early in the morning, actually. And it successfully launched, and its capsule successfully capsulated, and they spread their wings and flew into the cosmos to rendezvous with the International Space Station, delivering some supplies. So good for them. I'm sure they're happy to have food now.
Well, we have launched a Dragon into space. Although, from what I understand, one of the things that was complicated about this particular mission is that they had to have a lot of fuel on board. And one of the reasons why they have a lot of fuel is that, ironically enough, SpaceX, the people who are launching this, need to get their driver's license before they're allowed to get anywhere near the space station. So before it actually connects to the space station, they have to do a certain number of maneuvers to show that, yes, it will be safe to try and hook this up to the space station, and they won't accidentally sort of, well, have a mid-space collision, which would be horrific.
Well, yeah, we want to avoid that. It's actually going to get sort of plucked out by the arm, the Canada arm, of course, and pulled in, and then they'll dock, and apparently it even is containing science experiments.
Yes.
From little kids, so that's nice.
And actually, you know, they were quite confident, because one of the things they were wanting this to be, besides a cargo ship to the space station, which is sort of its money-making, well, maybe not the main money-making, but one of its main purposes, but it's also designed that they said if someone put on an oxygen helmet, they could actually survive the trip up to the space station if they were like, what do they call it when you sneak on board a ship?
Stowaways?
Stowaway, if someone had stowed away, which makes me wonder. Yeah, I just wonder, when the hook's up there, is Mark Zuckerberg going to pop out and say, hey, everyone?
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, SpaceX, I'm sure their ambition is to be more than just sort of a ferry between the space station and Earth. I'm sure they want to eventually be sending people into space. And, you know, if they're successful with this, I bet you they have their eyes set on, you know, Mars and moon bases and, you know, maybe getting in on that lucrative asteroid mining business. So,
ooh, yeah. That would be good. And this is one of those, you know, private-public partnerships. NASA has ponied up several $1 billion to help them along the way with this. But it will be interesting to see what the future of this is going to be.
Right. Well, let's leave SpaceX for the moment. We got a great show today on Radio Free Thinker. Some interesting topics to discuss.
You know, Ethan, you would think that the best way to convince people that vaccinations are safe is to simply tell them that they're safe. But apparently, that can actually be backfire on you.
You're kidding.
No. Apparently, to research published in the Journal of Health Psychology, overselling vaccination may actually work against you. They did an online survey, online test, sorry, not a survey. Just when I first, you know, you hear that, oh, online, that obviously seems to be a thing. But it's actually much more robust than you would think. The participants themselves were selected at random from a database of people who had actually previously participated in studies, but not ones that were related to this particular one. They were contacted by email, and most of the people, 50%, participated. Now, the reason why they wanted to make this sort of an online test as opposed to not is a lot of the information people are getting about vaccination is through websites. And so they wanted to kind of make this as natural as it could be. And part of the testing was to have people look at websites to get their information from it. The participants themselves, the majority of them were women, 66%, although parents were a minority, only 43%. The participants were asked to imagine that they were the parents of an infant, Sophie, who was 8 months, and told that her primary pediatrician had recommended a vaccination against a fictitious disease, which has some hard-to-pronounce name. The participants were then told that during a research, doing research on the internet, they found information that comprised of 2 to 5 typical anti-vax statements, and there was also a strong or weak negation. Now, what they mean by negation, because that kind of threw me at first when I read that, is they would then hear sort of a pro-vaccination message. One of the pro-vaccination messages would say, there's only sporadic evidence that repeated vaccination overwhelms the immune system. And then there was also sort of the strong or very confident message that there is no evidence that repeated vaccination overwhelms the immune system. Now, of course, having given them all this information, they kind of asked them 3 questions. One, I think the chances of my child suffering from side effects after receiving the vaccination are, and on a scale of 1 to 6, being close to 0 or close to certain. The side effects of the vaccination are severe, and you had, again, 1 to 7. I totally disagree or I totally agree. And they also had the last question sort of, is if you had the opportunity to vaccinate your child against this disease next week, how would you decide? And again, 1 to 7 as to definitely not vaccinate and definitely would vaccinate. So they ran this experiment and then they ran it sort of a second time. And the second time around, they had the source of the information had changed. So the first time around, the pro-vaccine message was from a government website. The second one was supposed to be from a pharmaceutical. And to be fair, the websites themselves were identical. The only difference was the logo and the name were one of the National Health Agency of Canada, and the other one was the Pfizer Corporation. So now they had actually 2 very interesting results from this. The first one, which of course is not exactly unexpected, is that when they sort of thought that there was going to be a bias, i.e. corporation, people were much less likely to trust the information and much more likely to think the vaccination may have problems with it, which again is sort of like, well, duh. But the second one, which seemed very paradoxical, is that the confidence in the pro-vaccine message actually made people less likely. So the message that had said that there is no evidence of harm from vaccinations actually resulted in people being less confident in the vaccine itself, whereas the one message that said there's only sporadic evidence, people felt more confident, which strikes me as kind of weird, doesn't it, to you, Ethan?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, perhaps it's that idea of being so sure that there's no danger that makes them suspicious. If they had said, for example, there is a 99% chance the vaccine will be totally effective and there'll be no side effects versus 100% chance, they might assume that, oh, well, they're overcompensating, they're suspicious. That means they're trying to sell me on something. Whereas if you have a more reasonable sort of number, percentage, whatever, people might think that, oh, okay, well, it may not be perfect, but the odds are so high in my favor that it's worth getting vaccinated. Even still, it is a bit of, if it is sort of like an internet poll survey test, it's not too much to base things on at this stage. I mean, I'd want to see a bit more solid research, a bit more perhaps from a psychological point of view?
Well, as I said, to be fair, I mean, it's online, but it was only online because that was sort of the nature of the experiment itself, was mm-hmm. people get the information from online. But you're right, the number of people involved in this were about 100 to 150. So it wasn't a huge study. But I do think it's one of those things that if someone out there the anti-vax movement sort of has planted a seed that there may be an issue. Mm-hmm. People are far, far more likely to think, well, there must be something to this. And if I sit back and say, oh, no, there's absolutely nothing to it, even if I was right, people say, well, if there is absolutely nothing wrong with it, then why are these people have a problem with it? So you must be kind of lying. Whereas if you say, well, there is a very small risk to it, it's like, okay, I can now rationally justify why these people over here have their point of view and understand why their point of view is just, they're just blowing it out of proportion.
Yeah, I mean, it does make a certain amount of sense that that would be a common psychological reaction to evaluating the risks, especially if you're not sort of well-versed in sort of the medical background of it. At the same time, though, I do have to wonder, because part of the way that the anti-vaccination movement has gained so much momentum has really not been focused on there is the potential for a risk, but the if you get vaccinated, you will kill your child. Like, it's not a nuanced argument that they're putting out there. It is a very direct, overblown argument. So I kind of wonder why they haven't also had the same effect on them, that because they're going out there and saying, listen, these pharmaceutical companies are trying to kill you. Vaccinations are a way to sort of sterilize you and give your child autism. I mean, they're not mincing words, really.
Well, I suspect maybe this is one of the where you have these sort of multi-platform attacks, right? So I think you're probably right. A lot of people who sort of do the fear-mongering go, well, listen, you know, my older child, sorry, got vaccinated and didn't die, and you're really overselling this, so I think you're probably nuts about this or what have you. But that's just the first level. That puts the kernel of doubt in the mind. You may ignore it, but then you get your friend, who's a reasonable person, say, oh yeah, they're overselling it, but really, there's more than you might think there is here. You know, that's why I think you get in a number of communities where this will sort of take root, because you'll have someone in there who is sort of the soft sell that allows it to proliferate in some communities, but you're not having it as a sort of massive epidemic across the country. I mean, to be fair, the anti-vax movement has had a pronounced impact, but almost always very localized in very specific communities and not an overall trend across the country, with some possible exceptions, because I think it's getting pretty big in some point. Well, no, even then, like England or Australia, I still think it's rather localized in communities, strong in those communities, the anti-vax movement, but still localized communities.
Well, it manifests itself in localized communities. I mean, the message does get out nationally. I mean, the damage that Oprah did, you know, about 5 or 6 years ago with her sort of publicity of Andrew Wakefield was pretty devastating. And you did see a drop in vaccination rates, but you only saw the sort of the tragic results of that usually in a localized community where an outbreak would occur. But, interesting research, and we'll have to keep our eye on this. If there is something to this, we may have to look at a revision of our tactics, so to speak.
Maybe we will. Less pitchforks and more, I don't know, Nerf balls?
Nerf balls, maybe, yeah.
Yes, but you know, this does lead to an important thing, that research is really, really important, right? I mean, these people are doing research, and we're finding more about how to make our message more palatable. But researchers in Canada seem to be an endangered species.
Well, they may or may not be. Listeners will have to find out after this commercial break here on Radio Free Thinker.
Listen, if they're so hot, how come they're not tearing up the charts, babe?
Because you never play them, babe.
At CITR, our hosts choose the music they play. That means our charts actually reflect the tastes of music lovers, as opposed to focus groups. So if you want to know what's really tearing up the charts, get your hands on a copy of Beatroot or Discorder magazine, or go online to CITR.ca. CITR's charts are based on actual spins motivated by actual preference. No payola, no marketing, just good tunes. Refreshing, no?
Subscribe to the Radio Free Thinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes. Subscribe via iTunes or at radiofreethinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@radiofreethinker.com. Understanding empowers you. And we're back on Radio Free Thinker here on CITR. So as Don alluded to before the break, it might be a bad time to be a scientist in Canada, particularly a marine biologist. That's because a program called the Experimental Lakes Area, a world-renowned research facility in southern Ontario, is being shut down by budget cuts by the Government of Canada. So the Experimental Lakes Area is a region of 58 lakes near Kenora, Ontario, that scientists have been using for groundbreaking experiments. And this is going to be shut down because of budgetary cuts. So in addition to the research facility being shut down, we're also going to lose 40 jobs in Winnipeg's Regional Fisheries and Oceans Office of Canada. So a lot of important public servants are going to lose their job as a result of this. The closure of the ELA has provoked some really harsh criticism for the government. To quote Harvard University aquatic science professor LZ Sutherland, "I was pretty shocked. This is one of the foremost research projects and places to do research in the world. To have to shut it down is just appalling. It's embarrassing." To quote Cynthia Gilmore, a senior scientist at the Smithsonian Environmental Research Center in Maryland, "I was stunned. The ELA has contributed to environmental policy for 40 years, and the long-term records alone on temperature and ice cover are absolutely invaluable." So it's pretty clear that this is a very, very important portion of research, and the facility that this place is operating out of, there really isn't anything like it in the world.
No, you know, again, because as was alluded to in the that one quote you had, this is a project that's been going on since, I believe, 1956.
Yeah.
And part of what they're studying is the long-term effects. In order to study long-term effects, you must continually to study them.
Oh, yeah.
And this is a lot worse than you think, Ethan, actually. The Department of Fisheries and Oceans has actually laid off over 400 scientists in total. Now, these 40 are part of that 400. But, I mean, there's been a massive cut to it. The Harper government's previous budget that they're passing at the moment has also cut the National Roundtable on the Environment and the Economy. And they've also cut the Canadian Environmental Network, which is sort of a network of other smaller environmental groups sort of thing. They've even cut a database that they're maintaining for the United Nations, which is about different research stations around the world. It seems to be a full-on brunt, and I mean, it's largely environmental scientists, and I hate to be the, you know, conspiracy-type person here, but there has been a really strong smell of something fishy going on, no pun intended, with regards to the current government's movement, and in particular with a lot of the pushback they got recently about environmentalists criticizing the oil pipeline that's going from Alberta to Vancouver, actually, I think just north of Vancouver, and how environmental groups have been saying, well, we need to do a proper risk assessment, and the Harper government saying, well, listen, this is essentially environmental terrorism. You're hurting the economy. You're all foreigners trying to invade our country. And again, part of this sort of pushback seems to be if you eliminate the scientists, you no longer have that background to say, well, you see, this is doing harm. Kind of the same thing they did with StatsCan. I mean, they're reducing the sort of ability for the Canadian citizens to know what it is that's being done. Another cut recently, too, has been with the Canadian Coast Guard, which is apparently suffering hugely. They're cutting the Vancouver Rescue Center here, I think Jericho Beach or one of the beaches around here. They're shutting down operations in the Maritimes, consolidating, which means instead of having like five stations on the East Coast, they're going to have, I think, two or three. Which means, I mean, if you get in trouble off the ocean, I hope you've paid for your private rescue service because the federal one isn't going to be there for you.
Well, unfortunately, there's no private option for the ELA. And the effect of shutting it down is going to be very far-reaching. So I mentioned a quote from Professor Sutherland. Before moving to Harvard, he was originally from Nova Scotia and worked for years creating policy at the United States Environmental Protection Agency. The research done at the Experimental Lakes on the effect of mercury and fish and waterways was discussed at the highest levels
of the EPA and helped form the basis of new regulations on coal-fired power plant emissions. And, you know, this is a major impact on our environment, on our industry, and it's going to continue to have major impacts. The works on the lakes has also led to continent-wide policy shifts on acid rain, changes to the way hydro dams are built, a ban on phosphorus and detergents, huge advancements in the battle against green algae that fouls Lake Winnipeg. So, I mean, not only has the ELA developed some really interesting scientific research on, you know, lakes and environment, but the impact of that research has had major impacts on keeping our consumer protection agencies up to code when it comes to, you know, the most recent developments of science. Now, the other great thing about a research facility like this one is that that knowledge is going to transition into the private sector, and it's also going to add to our economy and our ability to be prosperous by increasing our knowledge of how to have green technology. So those advancements to hydro dams, that's going to save a lot of money. It's going to save money for the taxpayer. It's going to improve our quality of life. So by shutting down the ELA, we're hurting our long-term investments in technology.
Well, and that's a big part of it, because you either pay now or you pay later. Because, I mean, if we do the research now, then we don't make the mistakes that will end up causing a lot of damage later. And again, like I say, there's a lot of tie into all this. Another area that's been hit has been the Action Plan for Clean Water, the Chemical Management Plan, the Contaminated Sites Action Plan, all of which are designed to protect fresh water. Those have all been cut. And Ethan kind of hinted at that, you know, we're going to lose these scientists. And it's not so much, well, it is an important part that they're no longer going to be employed, but they're no longer going to be in Canada. These are people who need to have jobs, and they're going to move. Recently, Canada was on the verge of upgrading its Arctic surveillance system to keep an eye on what's going on in the Arctic, to, you know, the ice flows, that sort of thing, right? And the budget cuts in this last one has forced the company that was building a new set of satellites for it to say, no, everyone has been fired, essentially, and they've gone to jobs in the United States, England, and all that. And even if you did ask us to build it next week, we no longer have the expertise left to do it.
Mm-hmm. One of the disappointing aspects of this that I was personally rather disappointed to hear about is they were planning a new project, a long-term project, studying the effects of nanoparticles, which is an emerging multi-billion-dollar technology on waterways and fish. So, I mean, like, nanoparticles, you know, nano is like Latin for awesome or something. So, I mean, like, this is a real shame. So what is the government basically saying about this? Well, federal officials have been quoted as saying that the ELA no longer aligned with the department's mandate and is not responding to our research priorities. So I don't know what research priorities Ottawa has that doesn't include safe water, environment, fish, all those things that are really important to Canadian industry and our economy. Maybe they need to have their priorities sort of re-examined in that case.
Well, you know, and that actually leads to an important thing, and why this is particularly important to us skeptics, in the sense that in order for us to make the appropriate judgments about what actions to do in the future, we need to have proper information as to what are the consequences, what are the cost-benefit analysis. And in the absence of that information, how are you supposed to make a rational choice? I mean, I can understand in one sense, in an ideological way, that they're not that big of a fan of some of the recommendations that have come out of this. But then that becomes a political decision where they can say, okay, this is the pending costs if we don't do this action. We think as a federal government that that's worth it because we're going to get this economic development or whatever it is that they have in their mind. Great, but at least we know where we start, because we have the information to begin with. And if we eliminate the scientists, we will no longer have this. I mean, again, I think this belays part of their thing. One of the things that they've done with this budget cut is they've also changed Navigable Waters Protection Act, and they've eliminated environmental assessments that would be done under that. And that's here in BC. So this is something that will affect all of us. And you go, well, okay, so what if they eliminate the environmental assessments? Well, again, how are we going to know if this particular project is going to hurt my children, like vaccines. No. What effect this particular project is going to have on me? I mean, do we sit there and we just say, well, we trust the corporation that's building this? Obviously, we don't have a lot of trust in our government, especially if you listen to what's going on in Quebec right now. Faith in the government is at an all-time low.
Yeah.
And this is one of the things where scientists can have sort of a protective bubble. You can ignore what they say, but you should at least allow them to come up with the facts in the first place to ignore.
The government did suggest that what should happen is that, like, a university should take over the ELA, which on the surface sounds like, oh, that's a good suggestion, but universities don't get involved in decade-long research projects, especially projects like the ELA, where scientists have to deliberately pollute areas of the water and run tests on the ecosystem. Like, that's just not feasible for a university. They'd have to cut through so much bureaucratic red tape for something like that. This is one of those projects that only a government has the ability to do. It's like the whole space thing. You know, SpaceX can send rockets, but if we want to go to the moon or to Mars, we need government funding. And that's like this.
Well, and that, I mean, like I briefly mentioned with the students in Quebec. But yeah, I mean, like, universities just have a heck load of cash lying around that they can afford just to step in here and start doing this. And again, we're talking about a long commitment. And universities quite often have enough trouble trying to make up their funds for next week, let alone to plan 10 years in advance to maintain a project like this.
So, I mean, look, okay, I get it. Some people are going to be saying, okay, listen, I get it. Science is great. This is cool. But I'm sure this thing costs so much money, we just can't afford spending all this money. Well, the annual budget for the ELA is $2 million. To compare, the cost per year of the Harper government's new fleet of fighter jets is $1.2 billion. Now, I realize that, you know, Canadians are a very warlike people and we start lots of conflicts, but I don't know if we need all those jets. Maybe we could spare, like, we could maybe put one jet in the hangar bay or something, put it in a museum and use that money to fund the ELA. I'd be for that.
Well, and you go into the other things that they do. I mean, I don't know if people remember the fake lake they made for the G20 in Ontario. Well, that itself cost about $2 million to build. So there's 1 year of the funding. The government also had a whole department that they spent, I think it was $5 million to $10 million a year on, that had no department head. And because it had no department head, it couldn't actually do any work. But they were still paying for this. And they paid for this, I think, 3 or 4 years in a row before they finally squashed it out of the budget. But again, there are places where you can cut that makes some sense. And then there are other places that just seem to be irrational. And not only that, as again, this smells so much like an ideological warfare of the government. Am I really out of line here?
No, I mean, when you sort of add up a lot of what they've been doing the last little while, that's why I think this is a really bad time to be a scientist in Canada. And that's unfortunate because, you know, we have so many talented, exciting people here in this country, and I think that we could really be shooting ourselves in the foot with if this continues. But nevertheless, let's go to a commercial break here on Radio Free Thinker. When we come back, we'll have part one of our interview with Seth Klein from the Canadian Center of Policy Alternatives. Stay tuned for that.
A long time ago, in a city far, far away,
CITR
was born. In the decade ahead, America will be in space.
CITR
is already there. Astronaut Neil Armstrong had this to say about
CITR.
It's one small step for man.
CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
Herbert R. Tarlick, Chairman.
UBC's Museum of Anthropology displays long-term and visiting exhibits of Indigenous art from around the world, and guided tours are free. Our permanent collection features one of the world's finest exhibits of Northwest Coast First Nations art. Our collection includes 36,000 ethnographic pieces, 535,000 archaeological pieces, and over 600 pieces in the Kroner Ceramics Gallery. There's a lot to take in. Luckily, at the Museum of Anthropology, final exams are always take-home. If you've never checked out this world-class facility, now's your chance. Museum of Anthropology is located right on campus and free for all UBC students and faculty. Come enjoy our collection and resources.
Hello, listeners. As we begin the first of a three-part series with Seth Klein, I'd like to welcome Seth Klein to Radio Free Thinkers virtual studio. Seth Klein is director of Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives here in BC. He has graciously agreed to share his knowledge and opinion on a number of policy issues, such as austerity, taxation, and inequality in BC, Canada, and abroad. This week, we're going to focus on austerity policy. Hello and welcome, Mr. Klein.
Hi.
Recently, there have been a number of elections in Europe, notably France electing its first, quote, socialist president in a long time. The Greeks also voting no to austerity by voting for radical left and right parties. Austerity programs have been implemented in the UK, Ireland, Spain, and Greece. It's kind of become the flavor of the day for governments. To you, what exactly is austerity measures?
Well, austerity is any time that governments are substantially cutting spending, purportedly because, you know, they claim they have no choice in order to bring budget deficits down. And so they are reducing the role of government within an economy, within a society. I would actually add to your list there that local elections recently in Greece also were a clear vote against the austerity of Angela Merkel. So across Europe, we're seeing a real pushback now where people are saying we don't agree that there's no choice. We don't agree with this level of government cutbacks. And we don't think that the public at large, and in particular lower income people who rely on government programs, should be paying the price for a financial mess that wasn't of their making.
You say wasn't of their making. So the austerity measures are sort of intended to fix a problem. What was the problem?
Well, I mean, there are some substantial deficits in some of these countries, not much in others. There's a lot of variety. But the line that you get is, you know, these are societies that were just living beyond their means and where people felt some outrageous sense of entitlement in terms of the benefits that they derive. But in fact, and this was true in the Canadian story back in the 1990s, where we were told the same stuff before Paul Martin began some very dramatic austerity cuts in the 1990s, which was that, you know, we were living high on the hog and spending on our credit cards, and we had to be pulled back. In fact, when you look at what was behind those deficits, a big chunk of it is a tax story, that the revenues aren't coming in the way that they should because of tax cuts that have disproportionately benefited corporations or upper income earners. Or it could be because of, well, in our case in the 90s, high interest rates. Or it could be that governments, in the case of Greece, you know, were involved in loan arrangements with foreign banks and paying interest rates that were usurious.
So austerity is happening in Europe, but what about, you know, the Harper government? You mentioned Paul Martin in the 90s, but I mean, is it happening, you know, in Canada? Is it happening in BC? You released a recent report about taxation, the BC government. Are austerity measures being enacted or experienced here in Canada, BC, and Vancouver?
Well, certainly not like they're happening in Europe. I mean, and in particular in Greece, where the social costs of what's happening are horrific, frankly. I mean, the suicide rate alone in Greece as a consequence of some of this is deeply disturbing. In the case of the Canadian context, I think it's a more complicated picture. I would say that what we have right now from the Harper government is an austerity government. Is an austerity budget, not to the same extent as Paul Martin. The cuts under Paul Martin were actually worse. In the case of the Harper government, overall government spending is continuing to increase because transfers to the provinces and to individuals are continuing to increase modestly. But when you look at the federal public service itself, the things that the federal government spends money on itself, we're looking at huge cuts now. So the direct public service is going to be cut by 12,000 jobs. But if you included crown corporations like the CBC, it's going to be much worse. If you include cuts to government contracts and a ripple effect through the private sector, we are going to be looking at tens of thousands of job losses. And that will have an economic impact that that's gonna feel an awful lot like austerity.
That's always been one of the things that's always kind of bugged me in a way with the way that kind of government works, is people sort of complain about, well, why are we paying for these services? They don't seem to be, you know, they're not there. I have to wait so long for my driver's license or something that. So then they cut back more money to these services, which just makes the wait even longer. And it's almost like that spiral down.
Yeah, and we are going to see that federally and provincially, where wait for things from the federal government are certainly going to increase with the kind of staffing cuts that they're looking at. By the way, you were asking earlier about the BC situation. I would say that we don't have an austerity fiscal situation in British Columbia. Overall spending is going up, but that spending has been concentrated in a few areas where they haven't cut, health and education in particular. Although, and even in the case of education and health, they're not spending a pace with what population needs are and inflation and that kind of thing. So even though overall spending may be going up, in other areas, particularly in environment, we are seeing big cuts.
So you kind of mentioned before that ostensibly austerity measures are intended sort of to reduce government debt. Does it work that way? I mean, is the real problem just governments are spending more than they have?
Well, austerity, first of all, we need to differentiate between debt and deficit. So the austerity programs tend to come in when governments have deficits, as there is in most countries right now in the wake of the downturn and the recession in 2008, when we saw these substantial increases in deficits. And for the most part, that was appropriate. You see, for the most part, you would expect, you know, governments to have deficits when they hit economic hard times. And that's not a problem. In economic terms, we're much more interested, in terms of the economic health of a society, we're much more interested in debt, not deficit. Meaning, you know, if you put this in household terms, we're not really concerned about where people are at in any given year if they're spending more than they're taking in. What we really want to know is what's their overall accumulated household debt, and is it manageable? Meaning, what's the size of that debt relative to their income? And the same is true for a society. Like, as economists, what we're particularly interested in is what's the debt to GDP ratio? Meaning, what's the size of the overall debt relative to that society's income. And in both the BC and the Canadian context, it's just fine, thank you. We are not in a serious debt situation. So you might cut spending in order to cut your deficit, but you might harm the economy if you do that, and your debt to GDP ratio might actually suffer as a consequence.
One of the things with the debt to GDP, from the what I've done, reading and writing, that sort of thing, Japan has one of the worst of these ratios, right? I mean, debt is so much higher than its GDP. I think it's approaching 200%. But the Japanese economy doesn't seem to be in the same freefall that you're getting in Greece. I mean, Canada may be in somewhat good shape, but how does that play out in the global market in general?
Well, first of all, the Canadian debt to GDP ratio is only about 35%. And really, that's why I say it's not a concern. We're in a situation where, you know, if and when we feel like we need to run deficits for a time, we can and should feel like we can do that. And there is a real risk, and I think this is what we're seeing in Greece right now. You know, and so Greece does have a high debt to GDP ratio. There's no doubt about that. But if your response is austerity and cutbacks, and consequently you further pile on and send the economy into a tailspin, then you're only going to make matters worse. You know, it's the old adage that you can't cut your way back to a healthy economy. When an economy is struggling, as the Greek economy currently is, and as a consequence, individuals don't have money to spend, and the private sector is nervous and not spending, then the government sector is the only game in town. And if it too decides to cut its spending, as is now happening, then you just go into a tailspin.
One of the things actually I've never quite been able to figure out, as part of the austerity measures of Greece, was the reduction of the minimum wage. Now, the other things about cutting services and all that, I could say, well, maybe, you know, I don't agree with that method, but I could see that you're reducing actual government spending. But how does reducing the minimum wage somehow reduce the debt?
Well, that's a really good question. And I think what we're actually seeing the Europeans and at the will of the banks who hold the Greek loans, imposing on Greece, is very similar to the old, you know, what we used to decry when the IMF used to impose a similar policy package on Latin American and African countries, which is structural adjustment. And a structural adjustment package generally, you know, takes the form of cuts in spending by government, but it also includes a whole bunch of other measures that are about purportedly making the economy open for private sector investment, which is a euphemistic way of saying cut regulations, cut wages, and make it an investor's paradise to attract back all of this private capital. First of all, it's unlikely to happen when an economy is in as rough shape as that. And secondly, to the extent that it does, it's a massive transfer of income and wealth to people. It's taking advantage of a situation to the benefit of some and where the majority is paying the price.
Sort of like Naomi Klein's shock doctrine.
It is the shock doctrine thesis.
You mentioned, you know, trying to promote the economy. Currently, the Harper government and the provincial governments are attempting to reduce regulations on the assumption that regulations somehow slow economic growth. I mean, this may be why the prime minister has decided to gut essentially the environmental laws in the current budget. What truth is there to this role of regulations and a sound economy?
Very little, I would say. Often you'll get people painting regulations with some broad brush, but arguably there are many kinds of regulations that provide a form of stability that actually encourages investment. In the case of what the Harper government's doing right now, I think, let's be clear, they're particularly targeting the environmental regulatory regime because their economic development strategy is all about the energy industry and oil and gas and trying to expedite its extraction and export. And so it's about clearing whatever regulatory hurdles are standing in the way of that happening.
I find it quite interesting that they've raised, you know, sort of foreigners interfering in our political system, and one make reference to money laundering and sort of pseudo-terrorism. And yet we rarely hear them complain about the money that, quote, big oil has put in towards its lobbying efforts and all that. I remember Ethical Oil, which was a website, I'm not sure if you're acquainted with it, which was essentially a front for tar sands industry. You know, it's very selective onto what is good and what is bad. But I mean, I guess it just belies their ideological background.
Yeah. Well, and not only that foreign money that's funding the lobbying, but the tar sands themselves is populated by foreign-owned firms.
I thought it was quite funny with the election they just had in Alberta. I mean, Alberta, which is quite often painted as the 51st American state, I mean, they are more American than many Americans are. And they're voting between the traditional right-wing Banana Republic Party and the even more ultra-right-wing Wild Rose Party. And it just struck me as funny.
It is, although, you know, there was something interesting in play in Alberta. I mean, it remains to be seen exactly what kind of a leader Alison Redford is. But she's certainly within that kind of broad conservative tent that is the Alberta Progressive Conservative Party. She kind of comes from the mold of the Peter Lougheed mold. Back in the day when he was the premier of Alberta, I'm sure most of us would have considered him pretty conservative. But we look back at that now, and here was somebody who was very cautious in the development of the tar sands, who had high royalty rates on the oil industry, who took billions of dollars of that income and put it into a long-term heritage fund for Albertans in the same way that Norway does, and which Albertans are still benefiting from. But there isn't a single conservative premier since Lougheed who've added to that heritage fund, even as the industry was exploding.
Well, that's one of the sort of changes of quote-unquote conservatism in the Western world, really, is from that sort of resistance to change, do things slowly, to essentially being more of a corporate puppetist. I mean, there is so much talk about, you know, we need to cut back welfare, but the idea of corporate welfare seems to go on quite strongly. And it's this, I don't know, as you say, seems to be a shift in what conservatism even means.
Yeah, you know, we had Bill McKibben in town a couple of months ago from 350.org. And he has a nice way of putting it. He, you know, he's organized this mass civil disobedience last summer in Washington over the Keystone XL pipeline and other activities around the world. You know, he says when you're coming to one of these protests, wear your Sunday best. We're the conservatives. And the people like Stephen Harper, who are prepared to play havoc with the ecosystem and the atmosphere without any appreciation of what the consequences might be, they're the radicals.
That's one of the aspects of regulation, is the whole idea that the externalities. I mean, you either pay now or you pay later. And often the pay later is society paying for things like cleanup costs or what have you, whereas now you should be putting money aside, the corporation should be, when they do these sort of events.
That's right. Well, and that plays out in so many ways on so many issues. But often with regulation, we're just trying to ensure that society as a whole isn't paying for the health or environmental or safety consequences of the investment choices of industry.
Well, this sort of leads me into my next question then. We hear so much talk about how important it is to ensure that we have a healthy economy, that we need to sort of restructure society to ensure a strong economy. To me, that's always kind of seemed backwards, that we should be really trying to restructure the economy to ensure a strong society. Am I wrong on this?
No, you're right. Yeah, the economy is a construct, and it's there to serve people and not the other way around.
But it seems that we have now, we've reversed that. I mean, whenever you hear politicians talk about, we need to sacrifice, we need to suffer ourselves to ensure the economy is doing well, and that...
Well, part of it, I think, is, and this is why, you know, the CCPA came into its own in the 1990s, arguing against the original free trade deal with the United States. And ever since, we've argued against different forms of corporate globalization, which over time shift the bargaining relationship, really, between a society and for-profit capital investment, where because those corporations are so mobile now, they are able to issue threats with more credibility to say, things have to be our way or we're leaving. There's a lot of bluffing that goes on in that regard, but there's also some truth. It's not for no reason that we argued as we did against these kinds of agreements. But I think what's also at the root of politicians saying what you just said, they say, and rightly so, is we too often, and it's not just politicians, in some ways it's the public at large, we become resigned to this notion that only the private sector and only the for-profit private sector engages in investment and job creation. And the second you accept that premise, you have to accept a whole bunch of other propositions with it, namely that we have to organize our economy and our wages and our regulatory regime and our tax regime in a way that keeps those corporations satisfied and sticking around. I think we would be much better off if we take a broader conception and say, you know what? They don't have a monopoly on investment and job creation. That happens anytime we combine human ingenuity and capital finances and natural resources to add value to something and create something of value. And sometimes the for-profit sector does that. Sometimes it does it badly. And sometimes we do that through our communities, through our governments, through our crown corporations, through our credit unions and co-ops. First Nations can do it. We need to change our bargaining relationship and feel confident that there are many options before us.
I find it quite interesting that a lot of the quote-unquote economic reforms has been made it easier for capital money to flow between borders, to make essentially a borderless society for money. And yet at the same time, there seems to be increasing difficulty for actually people, for labor, to move to one zone or another. And you have this sort of disparity of freedom. And I think that leads a lot into it. What can we do to sort of reverse this sort of relationship?
Yeah, well, you're pointing to an interesting paradox. I mean, you do get some neoliberal thinkers who at least are consistent, you know, who believe in capital mobility, but who also believe in free labor mobility. But they're kind of few and far between. More often you get neoliberal practitioners with a real double standard, which is, you know, mobility for capital, but labor not so much. I mean, I think a huge issue in terms of that bargaining relationship in Canada right now is this explosion in temporary foreign workers, which the Harper government has been expanding even further and now allowing employers to reduce their wages by 15%. You know, we need immigration as a society, but historically, immigrants came and were immediately entitled to the same rights as anybody else. And when you had labor mobile that way, it could allow for the gradual improvement in standards. But when labor, even when mobile, is restricted, when they don't have access to real rights, if they exercise their rights and they're rewarded with a ticket home, that puts downward pressure on wages, and it means that the gains of economic growth go much more narrowly towards capital and those at the top.
So, thank you for your insight and your information regarding austerity. Is there any parting message you would like to send to our audience?
Oh, I guess when it comes to the BC and Canadian context, just that there's absolutely no economic rationale for austerity. We're in a perfectly healthy fiscal situation. We can afford to take better care of one another and to protect the environment. And indeed, I'd say collectively, we can well afford to pay more in taxes to all ante into the collective kitty and meet more of our needs that way.
And if people want to find out more about the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives, they can get in touch how?
The website is just policyalternatives.ca, or the BC blog is just policynote.ca.
Thank you again for your time. Tune in next week, the second part of my talk with Seth, where we discuss taxes and taxation policy.
Standing on a planet. Really, I'm just a speck. I'm just a speck compared with a star.
Radio Free Thinker is broadcast Tuesdays at 3:30 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. You can also hear us Mondays at 8 a.m. on UMFM 101.5 FM in Winnipeg, Fridays at 3 p.m. on CFBX 92.5 FM in Kamloops, and Saturdays at 9 a.m. on CKXU 88.3 FM in Lethbridge. Our thanks to all the stations that broadcast Radio Free Thinker and help promote skepticism and critical thinking. If you would like to have Radio Free Thinker syndicated on your local station, please email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
We have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker here on CITR, of course. So we've had a great show today. We're running out of time, though, so let's go to our skeptical highlights.
And boy, do we have a few skeptic highlights this week. Is it like spring or something that everyone's coming out of the woodwork? I guess summer actually is starting up.
Pretty soon, at least.
Yeah. So the first skeptic highlight I have is the 2012 Best Illusion of the Year contest. Now, this is from their website. The contest is a celebration of ingenuity and creativity of the world's premier visual illusionist research community. Visual illusions are those perceptual experiences that do not match the physical reality. Our perceptions of the outside world is generally indirect by the brain mechanism, and I've talked about this once or twice about how we don't really see the world, we only think we see the world. The study of visual illusions is thereby of critical importance in the understanding of the basic mechanisms of sensory perception, as well as to cure many diseases of the visual system. You need to understand it in order to fix it. The visual illusion community includes visual scientists, ophthalmologists, neurologists, visual artists, among others, that use a variety of methods to help discover the neural underpinning of visual perceptual illusions. Now, the actual winner of this year's best illusion was the disappearing hand. Again, this one is best sort of seen on the website. We'll have a link on there. But essentially, you put your hand into a visual box and you get to see what you think is your hand, but it's really being manipulated by video cameras and it makes it disappear. There were three that I thought were quite cool as well that should get honorable mention. One is the floating star. So it's where you basically look at a static image of a blotty sort of star, so the little pigmenty sort of blotches on a blotchy background of a different color. But when you look at it, nothing's moving, but when you see it, it's moving. There's motion in it, and it's all based upon how our brain works with it. It's really, really quite cool. Another one, which is called TBA, but I think that's just because they didn't have a name when they put the website out, so to be announced. Basically, it's two moving dots that when you look at them directly, they move in a straight line. But when you look at them with your peripheral vision, they actually appear to be moving in an arch. It's actually, again, you won't believe it when you see it, but it really happens. And then the other one, and this one's been kind of going around the Twittersphere, blogosphere, Facebook sphere, what have you, basically flash face distortion effect. So this is where you're looking at two faces, and there's a small gap in between them. While you're focusing on the gap, the images of faces are exchanged with other faces in sort of a rapid motion. Now, all the images are honest to goodness human faces. They look normal. They look good. But when you're staring at the middle and they're flashing, you actually get really, really horrific effect. It looks really weird. So as I say, that will be on our website. Have you seen that one, Ethan?
No, but I might look at it later.
Just make sure you haven't had your lunch first.
Okay.
So, my next skeptic highlight for this week, In Search of a Better World, The Utopian Imagination. This is another one of the Philosopher Cafe's forums where Tiffany Wirth of SFU will ask if we can imagine the shape of what is possible. So again, utopia is one of those great ideas that just never quite panned out because, well, if you actually achieve utopia, you end up with a stagnant society. But still, is there value in trying to imagine such a possible future? It's going to be the 23rd at 7 p.m. at Waves Coffee Shop at 900 Howe. It's free. As I said, I have a few this week. The next one is Canadian copyright law for composers. I thought that would be really important for the local DJs and that are in our community. Music BC's Bob DeIth will give a workshop on how to navigate Canada's copyright law, which has been a huge, huge issue recently because there's been a lot of changes and it's become very, very questionable as to what qualifies as copyright, how do you enforce it, where does the actual value come from. This is going to be held on May 25th from 2 to 4 at the CMC BC Creative Hub. That's 837 Davie. It's also free. Another one, Evolving Democracy. That's E-Evolving Democracy. Online Voting Public Dialogue. This is the first in a Evolving Democracy Dialogue series highlighting current issues related to technology, democracy, and the theory and practice of collective decision-making. This event is designed for anyone who wants to help make change happen, including democracy and social justice activists, open-source coders, hackers, philosophers, academics, facilitators, conveners, and, of course, skeptics. This session will include a panel discussion featuring Andrew McLeod, a legislative reporter with the Tyee, Stephen Wolfham, a computer scientist from SFU, and Fithem Kadra, a UBC law and anti-online voting advocate. In small group discussions, people will basically get together, identify various issues, and again, collectively come to some decisions. This is going to be held on May 26th from 2 to 5. It's going to be at the Hive, Vancouver. That's 128 West Hastings. They are asking for donations, but it's up to you whether you want to donate or not. And then the last one for this week is Slut Talk, the Unconference. In-depth conversations about rape culture, victim blaming, and sexual stigma. Speakers will include representatives from Women Against Violence Against Women, the BC Coalition of Peoples with Disability, and the F-Word Media Collective. That's going to be at May 26th from 1 to 4 at Wise Hall. That's 1882 ADAC. They're also asking for donations. So it appears in this particular case, you can either be a pro-democracy person or a pro-women's rights advocate because they're conflicting. You were actually telling me before the show that the women's right aspect and appropriate behavior is becoming a big, well, it's going to become another issue at the next HAM.
Well, the recently, I believe, CFI hosted the first Women in Secularism conference in D.C., I think a couple days ago. And a lot of the prominent proponents of feminism, skepticism were there, you know, Jen McCrae, Rebecca Watson, many others. And apparently it was a really interesting conference. They had some very unique discussions. And I'm kind of hoping that we'll see some of those discussions carried over to like a conference like TAM. Apparently, not terribly surprising, but a little bit disappointing, was that there weren't a lot of men who attended this conference, and which is, I think, too bad. But hopefully, you know, we can start transitioning those conversations over to like a TAM or any other conference, really.
There's that sticky point is, you know, men may not feel like, well, if I show up, then am I trying to take over things, you know, because there's always that weird space.
They mentioned that there might have been some uncomfortableness regarding that, but hopefully we can find ways to work around that. But anyway, my skeptical highlight for this week, just one actually, not like Don.
Oh, Ethan.
Yes. Well, anyway, it's a good one. The Center for Inquiry Vancouver and the UBC Freethinkers are proud to present a talk on The Future of Blasphemy by Austin Dacey. Austin is a philosopher, author, and human rights activist whose work on issues of freedom and conscience and expression has been profiled by the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, BBC, World Service, NPR, The Voice of America. His writings have appeared in numerous publications, including USA Today, Dissident, and the New York Times. So it should be a really interesting talk. It's happening Wednesday, May 30th at 7 p.m. in Buchanan Room A103, right here on UBC. So I encourage you to go check it out. I believe there is a $10 admission. If you're a UBC Freethinkers member or a CFI member, it's free. So, I mean, become a member of one of those two organizations. They do a lot of good work and get in. I think it's going to be a fantastic talk. So, you know, I'm probably going to go. And then, so, you know,
that awesome. Sounds like something we should both go.
We should both go to that, yes. We'll see. We should cover that.
I have to contact my social secretary to see if I have an opening in my schedule.
Yeah, well, you're very busy, I understand.
Oh, yes, yes.
Very, very in demand.
Well, it's not so much the me, it's the voices, but...
Well, yeah, you do so many work.
You know, this is a bizarre conversation. I had a talk with a friend of mine who was talking about how the old people would put tinfoil on their heads, right? And say, oh, no, you don't need to do that. I go, well, how do you stop the aliens from talking to you? Meaning joking. He said, no, no, we've just gotten used to them. I went, okay, that's very, very pro-crazy, I think.
Or pro-intergalactic.
Yes, and anti-aluminum. And aluminum is an important industry in this country. We need to support the aluminum. Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
On that note,
we're out of time on Radio Freethinker. So this is Ethan, your freethinking historian, saying thanks for listening.
And this is Don saying eyes open, minds on. Bye, everyone.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first... the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Freethinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the star.